Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, speaking to you from Washington, D.C., with just a hint of the steamy summer to come down here inside the Beltway. I'm in the studios at WAMU in Washington, D.C., one of the great public radio stations in the U.S., something like the NPR flagship station for so many years. This was actually my public radio station when I lived here more than a few years ago. This hour, a conversation with Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who has fought the good fights in civil rights, on the streets, and in the courtroom, and is continuing the fight to give the District of Columbia official representation in the U.S. Congress. Plus, we also have the labor story of domestic workers who fall in a gray area for wages and protections. We'll hear how virtual slavery could exist for some workers within the borders of the USA. But we begin with the uneasy homecoming for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl and all the questions it has raised about the war in Afghanistan. For instance, if he left his post, was it justified? If he put other soldiers at risk by recklessly ending up in the hands of the Taliban, were rescue efforts to free him unjustified? What of the conduct of the war in Afghanistan and the casualties incurred to defend territory of limited or no strategic value in many cases, to apprehend Taliban leaders regarded as too dangerous to ever be released, and then suddenly let go in exchange for Bergdahl? These questions are all premature, says Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, who stands behind the president's decision.
We did the right thing here. I wanted to reassure them that the president feels very strongly about this. I feel very strongly about it. I've been to war. I know a little something about this. This was the right decision for the right reasons. We don't leave our people behind.
On Wednesday, it was announced that Bergdahl's June 28th homecoming event would be canceled. City administrators in Haley, Idaho, said the town would be, quote, unable to safely manage the number of people expected. Joining me now is Vanessa Ghazari, a journalist who has covered the war in Afghanistan since it began in 2002. Vanessa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, nice to be with you.
You know, Vanessa, I think we can all agree that we're all happy that Bo Bergdahl is back in U.S. hands at this point. But I have the impression that these questions that are being asked now and this discussion that's taking place is exactly the discussion that America maybe should have had years ago, perhaps as early as 2003. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. If you see this story, as some people do, as kind of raising these questions about, you know, the overall meaning of this war, what have we been doing in Afghanistan? Is it worth it over the last now 12, I guess 13 years? Yeah, I think this is an interesting moment for people to consider that, and for people, frankly, to kind of tune in on this story, which is often not at the forefront of our news.
What do you make of the Obama administration's statements on this? I mean, certainly he's been very compassionate, the president has, about Bergdahl, and very steadfast in his decision. But his comment that this war is ending and this is what happens when wars end, he's treating it as though this is some kind of fine print at the end of a long ordeal. I'm wondering if that sort of misses the point.
Well, I think he does make a good point on at least one level, which is that wars end with people talking to each other. And, you know, arguably, if we had had some of the conversations that we are now having with the Taliban, have been having on and off for the last few years, if we had had some of those conversations earlier, this war might have been shorter and we might have lost fewer soldiers and spent less money. It's, you know, it's hard to say, it's impossible to say looking back, but I do think that this shouldn't come out completely out of nowhere for people. There's no way we can keep folks in Guantanamo forever, even though there is this thing called indefinite detention, and we can't kill all of them. So the idea that we would ultimately talk to them and that some of them would go back under various circumstances, either to Qatar or ultimately to Afghanistan, is not that surprising.
Well, Vanessa, looking back over the long, years in Afghanistan, you've got the heroic moments in the beginning when the Taliban was rolled back in the very early days. Then you've got the neglect of the Afghanistan conflict as the war in Iraq escalated. Then you've got the return to let's get Osama bin Laden and the feeling that you know, the mission was completely justified once he was apprehended and killed. And now you have a sense of what are we doing holding these forward operating bases in these valleys where people can take pot shots at American soldiers. The literature on this war seems all over the map. How do you view it with the sort of long history that you have?
Well, I think one thing that you get to in your question is the number of times our stated policy in Afghanistan has changed over the last 13 years. You know, we went in with the aim of killing and capturing members of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, a very tightly focused counterterrorism kind of initiative and mission. And, you know, at a certain point, we began talking about, you know, all girls in Afghanistan should be able to go to school. And, you know, in 2008, 2009, we shifted to a pretty intensive, although brief, phase of counterinsurgency in which we were going to go into population centers and really change people's minds about who we were and who the Taliban were and kind of win people over to our side. That was an interesting initiative that came really late in the war. And at that point, you know, 10 years on, it was hard for people to take that very seriously. And it also wasn't very, it wasn't long-lived. It was a quick initiative that ran itself out. But, you know, I think the kind of the thing you talk about there are these forward operating bases and people, you know, soldiers are getting killed. Is it worth it? And is it worth it that soldiers may have been killed in the time after Bergdahl was taken and, you know, some of them were looking for him? These questions have been raised. We saw a similar thing happen with the Korangal Valley, which has been, you know, written about, and there's a great film about it called Restrepo. This was, you know, for many years the most difficult, dangerous part of Afghanistan, where, you know, there were tons of American casualties. And ultimately, the U.S. just pulled out of that valley after losing, you know, however many lives. And I think perhaps, you know, God forbid something like the September 11th attack should happen again, maybe we would think differently about how to respond, because a war is a serious thing to walk into, and you can't then get distracted by another war and sort of, you know, go on with your life when you have this kind of campaign underway. And I think that is what happened.
Vanessa Ghazari is a journalist who's reported from Afghanistan on and off since 2002. Vanessa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Questions about the war, questions about the post-war treatment of veterans, both are in play in Washington, D.C. this week. Senators are taking action to fix problems with the veterans' health care system. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Hey, Todd.
Hi, John.
So are these fixes designed to bring accountability to the system, punish the so-called culprits who created some of the problems, or are we actually dealing with the management and governance of the veterans' healthcare system?
There's actually a little bit of both, and it might be heartening to Congress watchers, John, who are sick and tired of Congress not getting anything done. I'm here to tell you that there actually is a deal afoot between Republicans and Democrats, a deal that could take shape as early as today. Now, not a final vote or anything like that, but actually a deal that's directly related to the scandal that we heard about. This Phoenix scandal, which is widening to other veterans'
right.
facilities across the country, has really narrowed the focus. So yes, it is about accountability and punishment, and it's also about reform.
And, you know, there does seem in the tone of lawmakers a serious sense to correct the problem, not a creating a campaign issue kind of strategy for 2014. That's pretty heartening for veterans.
And the people who own this bill are trying really, really hard to coddle it and protect it from the partisanship that can kill an agreement. I was hanging outside yesterday outside of Bernie Sanders' office. He's chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. He was in there talking to the chairman of the House Veterans Committee, a guy named Jeff Miller from Florida. Miller came out to assure a small handful of reporters that they're going to get something done here. Listen to Miller.
Everybody gets it. We can't fail. The crisis that exists today is too important. The men and women that are counting on us have been delayed long enough. Congress needs to help provide a resolution to the problem that exists out there.
Can they do something that's going to change the fate of veterans right now who are waiting for care?
Well, that's the idea. If you are a vet that goes to a facility and you're on a waiting list, both Republicans and Democrats agree, John, that you should be able to take your veterans certification, your money. You can call it a voucher if you want to,
right.
Though don't call it that because that'll politicize it.
Right, call it
a voucher. You can then go somewhere else to get your care. Now, that place might be an Army hospital within the DOD and the TRICARE system. That place might be a Medicare certified doctor. Republicans would like you to be able to take that money and go to any doctor. Also, even outside of the waiting list, if you live more than 40 miles from a clinic, from a veterans care facility, they want you to be able to take that money and go anywhere. Now, there's a dispute over how long that voucher lasts. You can imagine that a lot of people don't want that to undermine the VA system where everyone just goes to a private doctor and nobody goes to the VA anymore. So there's a disagreement over exactly how that would work, but they're trying to keep that disagreement pretty quiet and let veterans do that if they confront a waiting list.
There's precedent for this. There's always been a limited opportunity to do this sort of thing, but it's required a lot of paperwork. I gather they're going to streamline and simplify this process.
The VA has the authority to do this already, but there are tons of triggers and hurdles and things that make it bureaucratically hard to do and make it bureaucratically hard for the vet to get the voucher. So they're going to try to make that a whole lot easier. The other thing you mentioned at the top is accountability. Who can we fire and when? It's actually not that easy for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to fire executives who they deem are doing a bad job. Republicans and Democrats both want to make it a lot easier for heads to roll if another Phoenix is discovered.
I mean, as sad and as disheartening as the issue is for veterans who should never have been in this predicament to begin with, you really have to kind of rub your eyes and blink to see Bernie Sanders, John McCain, and Jeff Miller all, you know, smiles and working together on this.
The Veterans Affairs committees actually have a long tradition of bipartisanship. So within those committees, it's actually not that rare. People who get on those committees get on them because they care about veterans and they don't really care as much about sniping. When it gets outside, Congress is nothing but sniping. That's why Sanders and McCain and Miller are trying really, really hard to keep the wolves at bay here. Listen to Sanders. He came out of the same meeting with Jeff Miller last night to try to sound out the exact same optimistic tone.
Chairman Miller agrees and Senator McCain agrees that we can overcome the politics and not make the veterans of this country into political footballs. They deserve quality care in a timely manner. That's what the American people expect from us, and I hope we can deliver on that.
Will he be able to deliver on it?
There is a deal that could be announced as early as today, and I talked to people on both sides of the aisle who agree it's possible, probably not a vote today. Here's the heartening thing about it. You have Miller from the House, Republican, Sanders from the Senate, independent with the Democrats. And what they're trying to do, and this is heartening when you look at passing a bill, they're trying to pre-bake a deal that whatever passes the Senate, maybe next week if they get a deal, is pre-negotiated to pass the House. Sign off from Boehner, sign off from Cantor, sign off from veterans groups, get it through without any bickering that can always arise in a Congress like this, and get the president's signature, of course.
Does this involve more resources? Is there a budget line associated with this? Does it involve more spending?
Another big part of the debate, you're right to ask. Sanders originally wanted billions and billions more to expand the VA. That's out. One of the ways to keep this greased and keep it from getting controversial, no new money.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the effort, the sincere bipartisan effort to address the crisis at the Veterans Health Program at the Veterans Administration. Todd, thanks so much.
They might get something done, you bet.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now a constitutional battle with lovers, legal geniuses, and the towering characters on the U.S. Supreme Court. California's Proposition 8 was passed as Barack Obama made history by becoming the nation's first African-American president. The president's historic election coincided with a ban on gay marriage in the state of California. That was Proposition 8, passed with a campaign that claimed a homosexual agenda was trying to undermine children and morality. Chris Perry and Sandy Steyer had married each other in 2004. They were raising four sons together. In 2008, Prop 8 rocked their world.
What happens is you get a letter saying, "Dear Chris Perry and Sandra Steyer, we're letting you know you are no longer legally married. The marriage that was performed in San Francisco is invalid. And if you would like to have your filing fees returned to you, you may have them returned to you by check, or you can send them to charity or something along those lines." Just a form letter in the mail saying, "You thought you were married, but you're not."
The lawyers who challenged Prop 8 were two legends and legendary antagonists, David Boies and Ted Olson. They fought each other in the bitter 2000 Bush v. Gore presidential election case. But they were on the same side in this equally historic case. The story of these lawyers and these plaintiffs is the subject of an award-winning new documentary, The Case Against Eight. Ben Cotner and Ryan White produced and directed The Case Against Eight. It was a story that they said had everything, starting with the two attorneys.
They were called the odd couple by the press. They were seen as arch nemeses, at least politically, but little did people know they were actually very good friends, and they forged a very solid friendship during Bush v. Gore. And so the fact that they joined forces to take on Proposition 8 sort of turned the issue upside down and stripped party politics out of it and made it a real human rights social. And, you know, the only prominent Republican in favor of gay marriage probably at that time was Dick Cheney. And so I think Ted Olson deserves a lot of credit for the sea change that we've seen over the last 5 years, where it's pretty normal now for Republicans to come out in favor of gay marriage, and it's not really a party line issue anymore.
As a storyteller, did you worry that these lawyers would upstage the plaintiffs, who are Americans?
The initial hook to us was this idea of the odd couple of Ted and David coming together. But once we got there and we got to meet the plaintiffs, we realized that they were really the heart of the story, and their journey was, you know, very compelling to us, and that's what we wanted to share with people.
Did you think that they would win? Did they think that they would win?
They didn't know what they were signing up for. So, you know, we followed Paul and Jeff and Chris and Sandy and their families for 5 years. And I don't think – they definitely didn't realize it was going to take 5 years. And I don't think they realized that they were going to become the center of the firestorm the way they did. I think that they were confident in their legal counsel, but they were worried all the way up to the Supreme Court, as you would be if you were part of such an important lawsuit.
Well, you record in one of the rehearsals Ted Olson asking one of the plaintiffs, "So you got married to a man before, and you're a lesbian now, so you chose to be a lesbian, right?"
What if someone were to say, "Well, you've just chosen at one point in your life to be with a man, and now you've chosen at another point in your life to be with a woman. Couldn't you choose to be with a man again?"
When I met Chris and fell in love with her, it was actually the first time I could even identify with the phrase being in love. I felt that feeling of being completely taken over by my emotions in just such a life-shifting way that it's difficult to even explain. But something that I felt like, this is so big and powerful and wonderful. I can't ignore it. I won't ignore it. And at 37 years old, I discovered something about myself that I hadn't known before. I feel like I can choose what to do with the information I've learned about myself, but I can't change who I am. I simply am who I am.
And that is a lesbian.
That is a lesbian.
And that was a total curveball, too, because Chris and Sandy and Paul and Jeff didn't ever expect that there would be a trial. A trial was sort of the total curveball that Judge Walker threw in at the last second and sort of changed the course of this entire five-year journey. And so suddenly, Chris and Sandy and Paul and Jeff were going to have to go into a public trial and testify about their lives, be cross-examined about their lives. And as you saw in our film, that takes up a big portion of our film was their testimonies, because it was probably the most moving part of the entire journey for us.
How do you feel about being a plaintiff in a case trying to change the Constitution?
I think there are immediate, very real, and very desirable personal gains that I would experience, and of course, close family. But on a different level, you know, as a parent, you're always thinking about the other generation, the next generation, because, well, for us, they're in our house. So I really do think about that generation and the possibility of having grandchildren someday and having them live in a world where they grow up and whoever they fall in love with, it's okay, because they can be honored and they can be true to themselves and they can be accepted by society and protected by their government.
What did this case say about the law?
This case said basically that, you know, we as a society don't accept the idea that, you know, a majority can take away the rights of a minority. And Judge Walker's decision is incredibly moving. It's, you know, somewhere around 130 pages. Everyone should read it. It should be a part of every, you know, civics class in every high school. It's a really well-worded document of what it means and what discrimination is and why we as a society shouldn't allow that type of thing to happen.
And, you know, the propaganda that the Prop 8 supporters put out during the campaign back in 2008, among the things that they said in that propaganda, which helped to get Prop 8 passed, was if California goes this way, so goes the rest of the nation. In an odd way, in a way they would never have expected, they were right.
It's true. I mean, this was the first time a federal judge ever ruled a state ban as unconstitutional. And I think we've seen how many judges now. I mean, Ben and I premiered the film at Sundance in Utah. And a few weeks before that, a federal judge struck down their ban. Then our next film festival was South by Southwest in Texas. A few weeks before that, they struck down the ban.
Wow.
The same thing happened in Tennessee. The same thing has happened in countless states where we played our film now. Where now it's almost normal, even in the reddest of red states, that a judge is striking down the ban. So,
Riding a wave?
I mean, we'll see where that wave ends. A lot of people think in the next couple of years it'll make its way back to the Supreme Court, and it won't continue having to go state by state. But there's definitely some sort of wave riding now.
The one thing that we've taken away from this is in 2008, you know, we didn't expect Proposition 8 to pass. We assumed that it was inevitable that gay rights would come about, at least in our state. And now I think it isn't really appropriate to think that it's inevitable now. You know, there's still a lot of work. And a lot of the states where you can get married now, you actually can get fired for being gay still. So it's a fine balance between being, you know, celebratory of these great victories, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Sundance Prize-winning movie, The Case Against 8. Ben Kottner is filmmaker, Ryan White filmmaker. They produced and directed The Case Against 8. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks you for having us.
The Case Against 8 comes out in theaters tomorrow. It airs on HBO on June 23rd.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This week has begun a fundamentally new debate over how to deal with climate change. We've been focusing on it every day this week. New federal regulations will hold states accountable for meeting standards that have as a goal a 30% reduction in carbon emissions between now and 2020. In addition, other pollutants will get more stringent treatment from the Environmental Protection Agency, a dual mission of dealing with climate change and public health.
I'm here at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., visiting with some kids being treated here all the time for asthma and other breathing problems. Often these illnesses are aggravated by air pollution, pollution from the same sources that release carbon and contribute to climate change.
That's the president in his weekly radio address last Saturday. Is there a scientific basis for linking carbon emissions and climate change with more traditional control of toxic pollutants and harmful soot and particulates? Joining us is George Thurston, professor of environmental medicine and population health at the New York University Medical Center. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, nice to be here.
Is there a link between the two? Does one produce the other?
Well, there's definitely a link between controlling the carbon pollutants, CO2 and carbon, and other pollutants that travel along with them, especially power plants. They're putting out a lot of particulate matter, and they also result in ozone air pollution and other pollutants that have adverse health effects of their own.
Why has the EPA traditionally taken a individual chemical agent approach to pollution, measuring nitrogen oxides or sulfur dioxide or hydrogen sulfide, and not doing it more in the aggregate?
Well, that's the way the law is written. The Clean Air Act, written back in 1970, really did not address the multi-pollutant nature of pollution sources. And so each one is regulated individually, although EPA has been trying in recent years to try and integrate a more multi-pollutant approach to implementation, even though the regulations are pollutant by pollutant.
And is your voice drowned out by the voices on Capitol Hill that say regulations of these kinds are going to reduce jobs and make industry more difficult to compete in the rest of the world? Is that why this isn't front and center in the debate?
I think, surprisingly, there's a lot of politics in Washington, D.C., maybe not so surprisingly. Picked up on that. So that people who are opposed to cleaning the air are going to emphasize the costs. But the thing is that you really have to remember is that the costs are already there because this air pollution is causing people to go to the hospital, see their doctor, develop diseases like asthma and cancer. And so those costs are already visited on the public. And what we're really talking about here is moving costs from the public to the polluters, so that consumers can see those costs and choose in a more rational way between their energy choices.
Does the approach this week from the president give you a sense of optimism about the future?
Well, I have to say, it's the first time I've heard anybody in a leadership position focus on the health benefits of climate change. But when you're talking about cleaning up pollution, I think it's important to emphasize the fact that the people who do the climate mitigation are going to get the health benefits. They're immediate and they're near the sources. So a country should move forward with this legislation in order to gain the benefits for themselves. And it's sort of an enlightened action, enlightened self-interest, really, that they're doing the right thing for the planet, but they're also getting benefits for themselves. And that's, you know, studies have shown that the countries that do the most mitigation cleanup get the most health benefits. By 2030, 500,000 deaths avoided per year. And by 2050, if the mitigation measures are put into place, 1.3 million deaths per year avoided worldwide, and most of those in the most polluting places.
George Thurston is professor of environmental medicine and population health at the New York University Medical Center. George, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Our conversation shifts now to a discussion of domestic workers in the U.S. and how unprotected most of them are from the most basic fairness and safety regulations on the job. We begin, though, with a real worst-case scenario.
Lucy was working 7 days a week, on call 24 hours a day, 16 to 20 hours a day, and was not even permitted to go to sleep.
That's attorney Sheena Wadawan. Her client, 23-year-old Lucia Mwaka, came to Rockville, Maryland from Kenya to be a domestic worker for the Kenyan embassy's head of public affairs. She ended up in a state of virtual slavery and in a potential legal no-man's land of diplomatic immunity. Armando Trull is the senior reporter from WAMU right here in Washington, D.C., who broke this story of alleged abuse, joins me now. Armando, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be here.
This is an issue for Washington, D.C., because so many diplomats are here, but it really speaks volumes about legal protections for all kinds of domestic workers. How did you discover this story?
Well, I was approached by the organization that would ultimately rescue Lucy back in March. And that organization was listed in a booklet that Lucy had gotten outlining some of the rights that she had or could exercise.
So the State Department gives you a handbook saying, if something bad happens to you, here are your rights. But once you get inside the doors of the embassy residence or the diplomat's home, it's a different story.
Exactly. And in fact, Lucy had mentioned to me how she would read at night this booklet and how she would compare what the rights in the booklet were to her very different parallel universe.
And meanwhile, drowning out the words on the page from the U.S. government were the kinds of fear that was being instilled into her her clients there in the Kenyan embassy. Listen.
Threats of what's going to happen to your family, you are going to get deported, you are going to be homeless.
You know what a slave is, right?
Yeah, that was me. That was me.
She sounds empowered there, but when you spoke with her, I mean, she's really had a journey from terror to freedom.
Exactly. She alleges that during the entire time, four years that she was kept in these conditions, that she was not allowed any freedom of mobility. Her passport was taken away. You heard the threats that she alleges were used to keep her kind of in this condition of indentured servitude, so to speak. And then all of the promises that she was made back in Nairobi to lure her here. Promises of $9 an hour, vacation time, medical care for an accident that she had suffered back in Nairobi. And she told me that she had to remove stitches from her mouth herself because she never got any of these promises. They were never kept.
How seriously does the State Department take this problem, and how able are they to peer into these kind of diplomatic immunity bubbles?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because on paper, there are a whole series of legal rights that these domestic workers have. But when they go to these briefings, sometimes they're accompanied by minders from the embassy who say, well, don't pay attention to what you're hearing. That's not really the way things are. They would be told, don't speak to anybody. And so it's kind of a method of controlling these folks. Now, the State Department says it has procedures in place. In fact, sometimes the State Department is able to sanction specific diplomats and not allow them to bring other domestic workers.
But they can't be deported or prosecuted,
no,
right?
Of course not. And so it also it almost becomes a public affairs battle where the people, like, for example, the human rights organization that is helping Lucy is trying to get $200,000 in back pay for all of the overtime that she worked that was never paid for. But ultimately, it's just a matter of whether the embassy bows to this pressure because they can claim diplomatic immunity.
You know, great reporting here, but I'll tell you, the most heartbreaking piece of this is the lesson that Lucy had to learn here in the United States about what freedom means. Listen.
It's better to sleep under a bridge than to sleep in a mansion where you are always feeling like you can't breathe. I feel great.
Wow.
Wow, indeed.
She told that to you.
Sure.
And there are many, many others like her.
I think she told it to herself first.
Wow. Armando Truhl, senior reporter from WAMU, who broke this story of alleged abuse and is continuing to tell the rest of the story. It's a legal battle that continues. Armando, thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here, John. Thank you.
Everyone would agree that housework is work. But the people who do it for a living aren't necessarily considered part of the traditional labor force. It's one of those maddening realities that keeps millions of Americans in poverty or unprotected from unsafe working conditions and ineligible for quality health care. In 1938, domestic workers, nannies, caregivers, housekeepers were excluded from federal fair employment standards. The law was amended in the 70s to give them minimum wage coverage and overtime protection, but full parity has eluded the legions of domestic workers. The labor laws of 29 states specifically exclude home care workers from their own state minimum wage laws. Sarah Lieberstein is staff attorney for the National Employment Law Project and joins me now. Sarah, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
How would you describe the impact of this lack of parity between domestic workers? And we're talking about a variety of categories here and the rest of the labor force in the United States.
It's been devastating. These workers are very lowly paid. And not only are their hourly wages so low, but they frequently aren't paid for the work that they do perform. So often employers won't pay workers for time they spend working before or after their official shift. In the case of home care workers, a lot of workers are missing out on pay when they travel from one client's home to the other, or when they're working long overnight shifts and they have to get up in the middle of the night to care for a client. They often are not paid for that time.
And they can't really take this anywhere. It's not as though they can, you know, issue an ultimatum to their employer without fear of losing their job. And while there are, in theory, places where they can take charges of abusive conditions, most workers don't choose to take that route.
That's right. Domestic workers and home care workers are often in a tricky situation because they have a very intimate relationship with the people they care for the families whose homes they take care of. And so they may feel a lot of pressure not to complain and not to damage that relationship. On the other hand, there has been some movement for domestic workers and home care workers to organize, and home care workers increasingly are organizing into unions.
And one would think that the beneficiaries of a better workforce, a happier workforce, would be the people who need home care workers, that if they didn't buy into this exclusion mentality, that actually things would be better for everyone.
That's absolutely right. The more that we invest in the home care system, the more that we're going to see an increase in the level of care and also the stability of the workforce. These workers experience turnover and burnout at extremely high rates. So the person you might rely on to help get your grandmother out of bed in the morning might be someone who's brand new on the job or someone who's completely stressed out or even someone who's had an injury but can't afford to take time off to get better. And we're expected to add about a million new jobs to the workforce in the next decade. If we don't have good qualified workers who are paid a decent wage, this workforce is really going to suffer in the care along with it.
And given the human costs here, a certification program and an attempt to make sure that people are properly trained would make a lot of sense. Have there been efforts to do this, and where have they gone in legislatures around the country and at the federal level even?
You know, there has been some movement. New York State, actually, where I am, is making some inroads into thinking about how to create a real job ladder for the workers and give them opportunities to both increase training and increase pay. But I'd say at a basic level, this work is skilled. No matter how much training the workers get, they are performing so many different tasks. They have to be able to relate well to the people they care for. They often have to take on paramedical tasks. So I think the real emphasis has to be on improving the wages, improving the conditions and the benefits, and then we can ensure that the qualified workers are staying in the job and continuing to build their expertise over time.
There's a special category that actually relates to the expected rise in the number of elderly and infirm individuals who are going to require pretty much 24-hour care, either because of Alzheimer's, dementia, or in the case of veterans, people who have very serious injuries and who need in-home care. But that category of workers is almost completely unprotected. Describe.
Well, even after a new federal rules reform takes place at the beginning of next year, live-in domestic workers, including live-in home care workers, will continue to be exempt from overtime pay. So although the workers will gain some level of protection, if they're employed solely by that private household, they remain shut out of certain overtime protections unless the state they live in offers those.
And if a family member is performing that service, there is absolutely no tax benefit or any sort of reimbursement or any credit that can be given for that essential work being done.
That's right. A lot of care work goes completely unpaid because it's a family member performing it. Some states do pay family caregivers through their Medicaid programs, but it's true that family members are performing a lot of work and it's either completely unpaid or very underpaid.
Can organization address this in the sense that a strike-like event could have such an impact that people would really begin to think about this differently? Or is it going to take something along the lines of a workers' bill of rights that would have to go state by state to really change the way people view domestic workers here?
Well, the biggest reform is about to happen, and that's the extension of federal minimum wage and overtime protections to this workforce starting on January 1st. That is such a huge and critical step forward. It's making sure that workers get the very most basic of labor protections. And it's also sending a message that this industry is a formal industry, these jobs are real jobs, and that employers need to follow the law. States can also increase their protections, and that can go a long way, especially because some states have a higher minimum wage.
Sarah Lieberstein is a staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
So America employs millions of domestic home care workers, as we've been discussing. Have you ever been one of them? Have you ever hired one?
Hey, John. It's Erin from Pompton Lakes. Yes, I did employ a domestic home care worker. She was from Ireland, and it was a wonderful woman, and she took great care of my children. In fact, I wish I could still talk to her today because we had many enjoyable conversations, and my kids adored her.
Well, that's a storybook story there. We'd love to hear yours. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. From New York, I was a nanny for a stay-at-home mom. It was simultaneously intimate and demoralizing. Never again. And from Kirkland, Washington, in the early 1980s, I was a nanny for a family with a baby and a preschool boy. Both parents had demanding jobs and were often much later than expected. I learned a few years later when my Social Security report of earnings arrived that although they had been withholding FICA from the $3.25 an hour they were paying me, they never submitted my portion nor added their employer contribution. Ouch. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at thetakeaway.org. In Washington, D.C., there's the Washington Monument, the Capitol Dome, the Lincoln Memorial. And for people who live and work in the district, Eleanor Holmes Norton is a living monument to the battle for civil rights in America and the rights of people in D.C. to official representation. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton has represented the district for nearly 25 years. As the delegate representing D.C., Congresswoman Norton has the power to serve on committees in the House but cannot vote. She began her lifelong career in public service as an activist and helped organize what became known as the Freedom Summer, a movement that brought white and black college students to Mississippi to register black voters and build a grassroots campaign to destroy Jim Crow laws. Since we are broadcasting from WAMU in Washington, D.C. today, we wanted to spend some time recalling the 50th anniversary of that Mississippi Freedom Summer, a movement that finally led Congress to pass the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and Congresswoman Norton's role in that event as a young lawyer and activist back in 1964.
The first law we passed was not the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it did not deal with voting. It dealt with employment discrimination, and it dealt with public accommodations, which had been focal points of the movement. Now, why, you might ask, didn't we go for voting rights right away? As you might imagine, John, voting rights was the more difficult issue. You had to speak with Southern Democrats who had no expectations that African Americans who had been kept from voting would turn around and vote for them.
Part of the problem with the voting rights piece of this was that, like so much in the struggle for emancipation in the United States, these were issues that were determined by the Constitution to be state matters. Voting rights and voting procedures were state purview, state jurisdiction. And so the states could make the argument, well, we're just, you know, protecting our voters here with these laws, and it's none of your business, federal government.
Well, you make a very important point that I think may get missed in all of this. There is no right to vote in the Constitution of the United States. Isn't that interesting? The Voting Rights Act is controversial precisely because it intrudes the federal government, if you will forgive the word, into this jurisdiction of the states in order to acquit the principle that is in the Constitution, and that is equal protection of the laws. The reason it is so controversial today is because the Supreme Court has said, well, the time has passed, and the Congress is going to, we hope, and I'm afraid not this session, or at least not before November, but we hope Congress is going to say we make a finding that, in fact, some of the states still do need the discipline of the Voting Rights Act, and I think you will see what some of the states, especially some of the southern states, have done to mean that we indeed do still need the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to continue.
Your work in Mississippi is really interesting in all of this. And, you know, if you look back on the career of Lyndon Johnson and even listen to some of his recollections of what went on in the 60s when he was president and running for president, he tends to remember 1964 as a pretty darn good year for him. But there was one event where you and the Mississippi delegation confronted Lyndon Johnson directly in a year where he thought he had everything going for him. What was that like?
Indeed, that was a confrontation with our own party, the Democratic Party. I had worked in Mississippi for voting rights, and by the time 64 came and I'd just gotten out of law school, I was one of the authors of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party brief. That was our brief challenging the traditional Mississippi Democratic Party. Ours was a delegation of Mississippians that was integrated blacks and whites. And one of the great leaders was the great Fannie Lou Hamer. Lyndon Johnson was very afraid of Fannie Lou Hamer because she was a powerhouse. This is a woman with a sixth grade education, had worked on a plantation all her life, but when she spoke, she had eloquence that was on the level of Martin Luther King.
But the amazing part of this is that he was terrified that in a year when he had everything going for him, your challenge to the all-white Mississippi delegation in a public forum like the Democratic National Convention would hand an issue to the Republicans all of a sudden.
Well, frankly, I have to say now, looking back at history, no longer being, you know, a young whippersnapper, he had every reason to be afraid. Democrats had won elections in a very strange way. Since Franklin Roosevelt, a great coalition had been created. Those were Northern liberals and intellectuals, Western Democrats, and Southern Democrats. He was afraid if the Democratic Party lost the South, it could not win elections. But look at what happened. He won hands down the election. And while they gave us, our delegation, two seats, the delegation refused those seats. They did not believe that they could accept two seats when the Democratic Party of Mississippi was so clearly exclusionary.
Your entire career has been fighting for those self-evident truths that are in the Declaration of Independence, and some of which didn't end up in the Constitution, like the right to vote that's not in the Constitution, as you said. There's also taxation without representation, a self-evident truth that you've been fighting for right there in the district.
Yeah, talking about a truth that's not in the Constitution, but one that predated the Constitution. We went to war over taxation without representation, and it is a matter of the greatest irony that the capital of the United States would be left without, or would be left with, I should say, taxation without representation. John, the people I represent pay $12,000 per year per capita in federal income taxes. That turns out to be the highest level of income taxes paid by any Americans anywhere. The framers of our Constitution, the founders of our country, would never have left anybody behind. And the very last people they meant to leave behind were the people who lived in what was become the nation's capital.
Any chance that's going to change?
Oh, it is. It's got to change. You know, in 1964, there were people saying, is there any chance that we're really going to get public accommodations and the right to vote for African Americans and the right to an equal access to job? I mean, after 100 years and more when we haven't had that, well, we got it. But it only comes through struggle, John. Nobody gives anybody in this country anything.
Well, there's a lot of struggling going on in Washington these days with the divided parties and the inability to get anything passed. So maybe those neophyte strugglers there on Capitol Hill can learn a few lessons from you, Congresswoman.
I'm trying, John. Boy, am I trying.
Eleanor Holmes Norton is the veteran representative in the House of Representatives for the District of Columbia and has spent decades fighting the good fight for the people of D.C., and for us all. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to the folks at public radio station WAMU for hosting us today. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.